Deborah Herman, who has recently researched Dear Abby and the changing advice of the advice columnists. This report on the Dear Abby column was produced for Fresh Air by Charles Hardy, who is WUHY's resident expert on popular culture and the host of the Popular Culture Show, which you can hear every Thursday on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock.
Dear Mr. Popular Culture, while watching the last episode of Barney Miller last Thursday, I burst into tears, overwhelmed with the senselessness and insanity of our modern culture. It seems that all the good programs are being taken off the air. First Lou Grant, now Taxi and Flamingo Road have already been canceled, and we all know that MASH will be the next to go. And it's not just the television programs. Sirhan Sirhan says Bobby Kennedy would want him to be released, and people are paying attention to him. WABC has gone to all talk radio. They're putting commercials on public television, and it's in to be in the armed forces again. I just don't understand what is going on and feel so lost and confused. Can you help me? Signed, Bewildered in Bethlehem. You know, I get a lot of letters like this one from people who are having problems with their fast foods, who don't understand the new music crazes, or who are just having difficulty adjusting to new television programs. You know, people experiencing different types of cultural angst. And I like to try and help them. For many Americans, cultural change is very disturbing. But the volume of letters I get is really minuscule in comparison to those received by the interpersonal and lovelorn advice columnists. Now, people have always needed advice. But it wasn't until the last few decades before the Civil War that a real market for this sort of literature developed in America. It seems that during this period of economic takeoff, social change, and rapid mobility, Americans, torn loose from parents, the old community, and the values of the early republic, began turning to books for advice on how to behave and deport themselves. Problems of appropriate social behavior were the overriding concern of the emerging bourgeois society. Ever since then, we've always relied upon the advice of experts for bringing up our kids, getting rich, being liked, having better sex, you name it. But apparently it wasn't until the 1880s that a regular advice column for women appeared in American newspapers. It was during this decade that some savvy editors realized that a woman's page interesting females to read newspapers would attract advertisers' income. According to historian Deborah Herman, the first advice column for women appeared in the New York World in November of 1883. But firsts are always being challenged, so a better year to remember is 1895. For it was in that year that Elizabeth Gilmer began an advice column for the New Orleans Picayune under the name of Dorothy Dix. Gilmer's column would run for 55 years, syndicated throughout the nation, and eventually making her the highest-paid woman writer in America, pulling down some $90,000 annually by the early 1940s. Since then, her throne of preeminent popularity has been divided between the sisters Anne and Abigail. Now, advice columns are tremendously rich cultural documents, reflecting as they do a sort of widely accepted, I guess we could say for argument's sake, a consensus opinion on changing social attitudes and practices. And as such, they can be valuable material for the student of American popular culture. As an example of one way these columns might be used to elucidate the same, let's take a listen to Deborah Herman, an historian at the University of Georgia, who at the 1982 Popular Culture Convention took a look at married life in mid-20th century America through an examination of 6 months of Dear Abby's columns in 1956.
If we accept letters to Dear Abby as an accurate indicator, in 1956, the single American woman approached life with one overriding purpose in mind, to find the right man and convince or coerce him to marry her. In the minds of most, this goal was not easily fulfilled. Single women competed for what they perceived to be a limited number of eligible men. Further complicating the situation was the fact that women's eagerness for marriage was thought to be countered by men's reluctance to wed. As Abby noted, though many a young man desired a little romance for himself, Many felt less than certain of the virtues of matrimony. For women, the road to the altar was no primrose path. How, one writer asked, could a woman know if her man had serious intentions, that is, matrimony, or just wanted to horse around, in the words of one reader? An effective assessment was vital to a woman's future. She could not afford to squander her youth on relationships that were going nowhere, yet she must also avoid the aggressive behavior that would label her as a pushy woman. Most importantly, if a relationship soured, a woman must learn to cut her losses and move on. She would not, after all, as Abby cautioned, be young forever. Perhaps the greatest challenge facing the single woman stemmed from her need to be irresistible to the man of her choice while effectively resisting or at least limiting his advances. The contemporary wisdom went like this: if a man could get what he wanted from a woman without benefit of matrimony, why bother with a wedding ring? Marge, 30 and dating the same man for 10 years, provided a case in point. She wrote Abby that, "I have been faithful to him and he seems content with me. I work, but every night I cook his dinner at my apartment and take care of his needs. I do everything for him that a good wife would do, but whenever I mention marriage, he blows up." In performing the duties of a wife while unmarried, Marge forfeited the single woman's basic advantage, the ability to withhold her favors. Three somewhat more astute high school seniors seeking to avoid a similar dilemma asked Abby, just how far should a girl go? They wrote, "We have been told that if a girl shows a boy too much affection, she is considered casual, and no nice boy will have anything to do with her. Then on the other hand, if we don't show the boy some affection, they won't ask us out again. We want to be popular." Abby's solution to this dilemma was simple in theory, if not in practice. The girl who wanted to be popular but protect her reputation needed, in Abby's words, to leave something for the boys to come back for. Okay, despite the fact that it was not an easy task for a woman to find a husband, not any man would do, and this is a theme that also comes up in the columns. I'm going to skip some of the material I have here, but I just want to point out that you can't marry somebody who has the wrong political attitudes, certainly the wrong race. And it's also not possible, or it's not approved of, for you to marry someone, or let me put this a little bit differently, for you to get involved in a relationship which defies the conventional standards. One example of this is provided by a woman in her early 40s who wrote Abby that she had met two young men at a dance and was considering sharing their apartment in order to save money. She said that she was not interested in what people will say, but only in whether or not the arrangement could work out. Abby's response was unequivocal, and she stated that whether or not this was practical, that it was certainly immoral. And what this example makes clear, I think, is that part of the reason that women are intensely eager for matrimony is that marriage exists not in a range of alternatives, but as the only generally acceptable alternative to the single life. And this fact explains why the woman who couldn't get the man she wanted very often felt compelled to settle for the man who was available. Now, in the case of why men are reluctant to wed, this is a question that I think Dear Abby is less illuminating on, partly because of the fact that whereas married men write in fairly frequently, letters from single men are less common. I think, this is speculation on my part, that men were generally reluctant to take on the responsibilities for marriage, the responsibilities for supporting a family. And compared to single women, they had fewer anxieties about the prospects that they could always find a partner if they wanted to, and their attentions were very much in demand, or at least this was the perception. So this may explain some of the reason why men are not as eager to get married in the mid-50s, or at least apparently are not. If we look at married life, however, you see that the situation of the two sexes is rather different. While the single woman eagerly awaited her wedding day, married life, letters to Dear Abby reveal, often failed to live up to her expectations. For the married woman, family responsibilities became the center, if not the whole, of her existence. Abby discouraged wives from working outside the home, even where childcare did not present a problem, and the wife's income could have contributed significantly to the family's living standard. When one wife suggested that a night out would help her to forget her troubles, Abby seconded her husband's objections. Stay home and care for your family, she advised, and you will have fewer troubles to forget. In another case, an intellectual type who became so engrossed in her reading that she neglected to prepare her husband's dinner was told to start being a wife or risk losing her husband. For some women, running a household, raising children, and probably holding paid employment as well proved overwhelming. An old-fashioned wife found herself too tired after washing, ironing, cooking, and cleaning, and gardening all day to go square dancing with her husband. He put in an 8-hour day while she worked 16. Wives whose interests took them away from familial duties drew husbands' anger and Abby's disapproval. One woman became so involved in church work, civic activities, and a bridge club that she forgot her work at home. Her husband wrote Abby. She comes home at 6:45, throws a cold meat sandwich together, and serves it with potato chips on a paper plate. This is dinner. If I want a decent meal, I have to take her out. She gets a liberal allowance to run the home, but she's never home to do it. While women were expected to subordinate personal desires to family life, men's preferences, in contrast, took precedence over all other considerations. One woman described herself as fed up after moving 16 times in 9 years for the sake of her husband's career. Yet Abby advised that he had to come first, and this is despite her complaints that it was bad for the children. The wife of a good-looking playboy was informed that while a leopard might never change his spots, she must learn to live with them. Graceful acceptance of the inevitable was the hallmark of a good wife. Despite the family's acknowledged patriarchal structure, wives did, in some cases, exert considerable influence. To the extent that a husband desired his wife's love and approval, he granted her a degree of control over family life. Wives sometimes gained power through sheer intransigence. For example, a wife who went bowling with friends one night a week repeatedly returned home late. Her husband established a midnight curfew, which she did not tolerate. When he locked her out of the house, she simply went home to mother. Control of family purse strings also represented an area in which male prerogative presumably gave men control over their wives' activities. But even here, it turns out that a husband's control could prove tenuous in certain cases. With money a symbol of status and power, many men felt compelled to fulfill their spouse's every desire, partly as a way of affirming their own success. And here I might refer you to Thorsten Veblen's writings on this subject. This could lead to problems, however, as one San Franciscan discovered when his wife began running up charge account bills as if she was married to a millionaire. In some cases, men voluntarily gave up control of family finances to wives who they regarded as better money managers, but these men generally tended to be uneasy about their actions and preferred their wives to exercise their power unobtrusively. Direct challenges to the husband's authority most often took place in the household, woman's acknowledged domain. One wife, an ex-WAC captain, ran her home like an army post, much to her husband's distress. Yet Abby advised him that women secretly like to take orders from a man if he will stand up and give them. Besides, as husband, Abby claimed, he outranks her. Such beliefs represented the major ideological and psychological support for the husband in his effort to dominate the wife. If he could ignore what she said and rely on her presumed desire to be subordinate, he need not feel like an oppressor, for she merely got what she wanted. The stresses involved in an unending jockeying for position and power must have been considerable in many marriages. Husbands and wives may in some cases have been evenly matched when it came to verbal conduct, combat, and strategic maneuvering, but women frequently found themselves at a disadvantage when marital disputes led to physical confrontations. In a rage, one husband hit his wife with a lamp. A husband with a terrible Irish temper regularly punched his wife around. Angered when he found holes in his socks and a button missing from his shirt, another punched his wife in the nose. Yet another beat up his wife for what she termed no good reasons. The first three wives all expressed uncertainty about their right to protest such behavior. The last woman repeatedly forgave her mate his periodic fits of violence. Abby advised the wife of the man with the Irish temper that the woman who sticks around after such treatment will only find sympathy in the dictionary. In contrast, the woman who failed to darn her husband's socks was informed that she had no problem other than neglect of wifely duties. Not surprisingly, when romance went out of a relationship, one or both partners often looked elsewhere for satisfactions missing in their marriages. The impulse toward infidelity commonly stemmed from the feeling that one's spouse was no longer the person one had married. After years of marriage, a woman seldom looked or acted in the same way she had as a newlywed. She might have gained weight, neglected her appearance, or lost interest in sex. Nor was hubby Prince Charming as many young brides might have hoped. He gambled, drank too much, failed to fulfill his promises, proved unable to hold a job, lied compulsively, refused to take a bath, watched TV all night in his underwear. The complaints that appear in the column are virtually endless. For the disenchanted, faithlessness was often quite easily justified, as in the case of one 55-year-old man who was enamored of his son's 18-year-old girlfriend. He explained, "My wife is stout, and I can't stand stout women. This girl is exciting and makes me feel young again." The possibility of infidelity meant that husbands and wives had a difficult time trusting one another. The women their husbands met at work were often the object of many wives' jealous concern. Abby advised wives not to meddle in their husbands' affairs, at least not until they had ample evidence of hanky-panky. But even the wife who had no proof of her husband's faithlessness often felt compelled to stick it out, who had proof. Sometimes she did so for the sake of the children, sometimes out of a hope of reforming her errant mate. Some wives claimed to be mystified by the type of woman their husbands chose as lovers. "What can those cheap girls offer him that I can't?" wondered one. Another suggested that she might have forgiven her mate had he picked out a decent, respectable girl. Yet obviously no woman involved in an affair with a married man could have qualified as respectable in most eyes, at least not in this period. Men also worried about their wives' fidelity, but their concerns often were tinged with a kind of ludicrous quality. For example, even after 50 years of marriage, Daddy worried about the report of a friend that Mommy was playing around. In another case, a husband's suspicions grew out of his apparent ignorance of the demands of caring for a home and young children. He wrote Abby, "When I come home at night, my wife is always so dead tired that I wonder if maybe she isn't favoring someone else with her affections during the daytime. I realize she has a lot to do in this big house with seven kids, but can a woman be this worn out from this alone?" Extramarital relationships were least threatening when they remained clandestine. The rare spouse who openly confessed a desire to have relationships with other men or women most likely merely confused his or her husband or wife. While some might wonder if this was indeed the modern way, Abby had no doubt that it was not. Unabashed disavowal of the rules was extremely disturbing. The husband or wife caught in the act might recant their sins or protest that love overrode marital vows, but the spouse who claimed the right to extramarital relationships challenged the whole conception of marriage. When marriages did fail, it was most often the cumulative effect of multiple problems. But expected never to abandon hope that their marriages could be saved, most women felt that they had to endure the unendurable. One wife cited the lack of support, association with a no-good crowd, excessive drinking, and possible bigamy as her husband's major flaws. Yet she asked Abby for help in resisting his demand for a divorce so that she might preserve her marriage. Despite the difficulties and disappointments of married life, spouses were expected to maintain faith in the viability of the institution. Finally, women so often disillusioned by their own marriages were expected not to communicate such feelings to their daughters. Mothers may know from sad experience that the white-hot flame of love will soon die out, but as Abby warned, she must not sour her daughter on romance. Well, married life, as pictured in Dear Abby, clearly involved disappointment for both sexes. The evidence indicates, however, that wives must have been the more acutely disillusioned, since as single women they had held a highly positive view of marriage, in contrast to their future husbands, who had exhibited a reluctance to marry that reflected possibly their understanding that marriage entailed potential disadvantages as well as gains. A close reading of the complaints lodged by husbands and wives, however, reveals another reason for women's disenchantment. While men tended to direct their complaints toward their particular spouse, women's problems often transcended the peculiarities of their partner and stemmed ultimately from the nature of the institution of marriage, particularly that of the role of wife. In general, men's complaints about marriage centered on the shortcomings of their partners and the difficulties of enforcing their male prerogatives on recalcitrant spouses. Men wanted, it seems, wives they considered attractive and who would perform a woman's traditional domestic duties efficiently and without complaint. Men's complaints generally reflected a wife who had lost her beauty, neglected her responsibilities, or refused to defer to his wishes. For these men, infidelity or remarriage, especially to a younger, more attractive, or a more compliant mate, provided a means of replacing what he regarded as essentially a defective wife and thereby restoring his faith in the institution. In contrast, a woman's problems were far less likely to stem from the specific characteristics of her own mate, though certainly I don't want to claim that these were not contributing factors, but it seems to me that they are, at least in part, structurally inherent in the role of wife. The proper 50s wife was expected to be deferential to her husband, whatever his character defects or weaknesses. Should she rebel, he presumed the right and often had the means to compel her compliance. Even with a lenient or understanding mate, she was saddled with major responsibility for household chores and child rearing, whether she worked outside the home or not. As Abby remarked, marriage isn't a 50-50 proposition, it's more like 80-20, and the little woman is at the long end of the arithmetic. But if it was marriage itself that stood at the heart of women's problems, I think few understood this fact. As advice columns like Dear Abby indicate, individual experience was understood through the distorting filter of social stereotypes and societal expectations. Personal experience seldom led individuals to challenge cultural definitions of their roles because that experience was itself understood in terms of those definitions. Women lamented their own unhappy marriages, but few criticized the institution itself. As John Stuart Mill has commented, though women do not complain of the power of husbands, each complains of her own husband or of the husbands of her friends. Dear Abby, I think, bears out Mill's observation. But it also suggests, I think, that what was startling about a work like Betty Friedan's 1963 critique of the American housewife situation, The Feminine Mystique, was not its charge that large numbers of housewives were unhappy. Readers of Dear Abby were already well apprised of this fact. Indeed, I think the expectation of happiness in marriage is largely the single woman's myth, a myth that is individually and perhaps inevitably punctured for women by the experience of marriage. Instead, I think Friedan's impact came from the explanation she gave for this unhappiness and from her insistence that it was intolerable and could be avoided. Furthermore, Friedan suggests that unhappiness in marriage was endemic to the institution itself rather than an affliction striking only the unwisely married. She held that unhappiness had come to be the standard condition of the American wife, not the price paid by a mismated few. In short, Friedan challenges the rules and called for a redefinition of women's obligations and opportunities as wife. And in so doing, in essence, she usurps the columnist's role and offers a new set of rules, a new means for interpreting women's experience in marriage, and thereby called for major social changes initiated by women on their own behalf.
Dear Abby, my feet are too long. My hair's falling out and my rights are all wrong. My friends, they all tell me that I've no friends at all. Won't you write me a letter? Won't you give me a call? Signed, Bewildered.
You've been listening to Deborah Herman, an historian at the University of Georgia who spoke at the 1982 Popular Culture Convention on Married Life in 1950s America, as seen through the columns of Dear Abby.